All Eyes on Fishing with Mitch Peterson, Brad Qualley, and Josh Sheldon. Welcome to the next level.
Hey everybody, welcome back to All Eyes on Fishing, the next level. Our guest, Dan Swanson. Now, we just heard from Dan talking about some basics with Lowrance or your fish finder and what it takes to be successful with that. But now we're going to dive into a little bit more. What Dan does, because he's fished so many tournaments over his career, what he does to be successful, and also some more questions that we have for him to get a little more in depth on what's going to make you successful looking at your fish, at your fish finder.
Yep. So,
hey Dan, I actually have a question for you.
Okay.
What if you had to pick one of the features of your Lowrance, which one do you think benefits you the most in a tournament situation?
In a tournament?
I know, kind of a broad question.
Yeah, it's a very broad question. I look back in time and I go, how did I ever fish without it?
Well, you used to fish with the paper rolls.
No. I wanted one so bad, but I couldn't afford it. So, no, I used a flasher.
The flasher. Yeah,
I couldn't afford paper. I couldn't afford a paper.
Yeah, those dot matrix printers, they're terrible.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, no, I'm teasing.
They weren't dot matrix. Anyway, you're talking to an engineer. Be careful.
I know. Yeah, I know your background. I knew that would get you. You're like, no, that's not true.
On the original podcast, I was going to warn everybody that Dan is a retired HP engineer and to step lightly when you start throwing out terms.
So. Yes. Dot matrix, Dan. That's going to stick with you now.
I do that to the guys in the stereo store. Anyway. you know, learning how to run your standard 2D sonar is probably the first thing we've ever had. It's probably the most important thing to know how to use. Mm-hmm. If I was going to go second, the second thing I would want is the maps that are available today, my maps and my GPS. Those two things working together has probably done more for my fishing ability than just about anything else.
Because that's really putting you on good contour, good structure. You know what that bottom looks like, having those detailed maps.
Yeah, the maps help you identify where to start fishing.
Sure.
Right? Or if you understand anything about the behaviors of your fish or the forage, you know, what they eat, knowing what kind of structure you're looking for, whether it's an offshore hump or a saddle or, you know, or a long point, or if I'm looking for, if I understand how my sonar works, I'm looking for transitions from hard to soft bottoms. Mm-hmm. You know, crayfish will dig into the rocks, or bugs will be in the mud. So you're looking for those places where you've got that kind of bottom. That's the bottom hardness part. That's understanding how your sonar itself works.
Well, and I've got a quick story, and Dan, you'll remember this, but this is a great illustration of kind of what we're talking about and what I learned from you one time, which has stuck with me, and I use it, you know, almost every year at different lakes. But Dan and I were fishing a tournament at Boisen Reservoir in Wyoming, and it was a little bit later in the year, so the weed growth was coming up to the top of the water, and it was one of those deals where we'd gone around and looked for fish, and we trolled, and there was weeds coming up in even the deeper water, and we trolled over those and kind of found some fish here and there, but nothing great. And we went through a part on this back bay where no one was because the weed growth was so thick, and Dan said, "Did you see all the fish?" And I said, well, I don't
saw a lot of weeds.
Yeah, I saw a ton of weeds, and I saw a bunch of crap on the screen, but I don't know if I saw fish. So we went back through, and he started to point out the sensitivity and, you know, the different fish. And we were marking fish in the viney, heavy weed cover that all the way up to the surface. And the fish were just below the surface in the tops of the weeds. And we set up, fishing planer boards and pulling spinners through the tops of the weeds. And we did really great that tournament. And we were top 10 finish and just caught a ton of fish by ourselves the entire tournament because we went back there and dared to fish for walleyes in heavy weed cover. And the fact that when we rolled through, Dan was able to pick out the fish as they were situated in the weed cover, and that made all the difference.
Yeah, what a great learning moment for you, because I know, and you know what, because of that, and this is funny, Dan, because of that experience that Josh had, he shared that with me and Mitch. And now we have done that. When we were in Sterling, we found a bunch of fish marked up in some weeds that people weren't fishing.
Yep.
Because we learned that.
Yep.
So the expertise that you have is awesome. And we appreciate you sharing it with us and also the listeners.
I look at it like helping the kids on the short bus, Dan. So I you know, give it to these two and off we go.
Yeah.
What would we do without you?
What would we do without Josh? Oh, my God. Yeah.
So that's a good example. I don't know, Dan, if you have another example, but that one always sticks with me, and I use it all the time, and I have spread it on to those less fortunate, but you know, it does work. It does help.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thought. Now that you mentioned it, is one of the things that this had to go back to a few years ago. We were actually filming a TV show up at Glendo, and we were jigging spoons. In this is first day of October, actually, and we went over some fish in about 20 feet of water, and there was a bunch of walleyes down there. We couldn't get them to bite, and I said to the TV host, I said, well, let's come back later in the afternoon when these fish move off the bottom and move up shallow. And then we proceeded, you know, we came back a couple hours later and we whacked them up in shallower water throwing spoons up shallow. And if we hadn't spotted those fish on the bottom, we would have, you know, probably would have found something else, but at least that worked.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we've done that before where we've seen fish deep in the earlier hours, you know, in the morning hours. And then as the wind blows or, you know, the day heats up, you and I have come back and gone over those same fish, and those fish have risen up 10, 15 feet. Or like we've seen at other reservoirs that you and I fished where they come up for that night bite, and those fish start to rise up from 20 or 30 feet. And before you know it, the bait balls and the arches are just below the surface, and it's game on. So, picking all that stuff up has just been an unbelievable way for us to catch more fish.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, so Dan, this summer I got a HDS-9. And let me tell you, it's awesome. I love it. I didn't get to spend enough time in my boat though staring at it.
Yeah.
But that was the one thing that I know it has improved, you know, surface clarity basically, so you can mark fish up higher. I remember, you know, fishing those fish at night where they would come up and right at dark, they were kind of up in the clutter where you can't really see them. With the new HDS units, can you spot those fish now?
Yeah, to a point. You got to realize that the cone of the transducer is the diameter of the cone is only a third of the depth. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to pick up fish in 10 feet of water or 10 feet below the surface, the diameter of that cone's only 3 feet in diameter. Mm-hmm. So your probability of seeing those fish isn't that high.
Right, right,
right.
So you have to go right over them.
Yeah.
Or is it more of a size function?
If you get right on top of them in that shallow water, you may spook them out to the side, and that's where your planer boards can be an advantage.
So what's the difference in the, you know, you see people different megahertz. What should you be running your transducer cone at then?
So 83 kilo. So generally, when you're talking about standard 2D mm-hmm. transducers, they run, they'll have a fixed frequency of 83 or 200. Mm-hmm. And then there's chirp, which spans in between, but we won't get into that. Mm-hmm. At 83 kilohertz, you will have a little wider cone, mm-hmm. and you don't need as much power to get real deep. So you can pick up fish at 83 wider than just that one third that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You can go probably 10 feet in diameter in 10 feet of water at 83. At 200, then the cone is narrower, or at least it appears to be narrower. So you get more target definition, but you don't get any more width. So I have a good friend who's a lake trout guide, and he actually runs his screen split between 83 on one panel and 200 in the other. Mm-hmm. And that because he having that extra width helps him pick up those fish that may not be directly underneath the boat.
So the guys that are just setting up their boats, what do you suggest that they run it at then? I mean, I'm sure mm-hmm. over time learn to be able to use both, but what is the go-to? I mean, if you're just in general terms.
I like 200 kilohertz mostly because I get a better picture and better target separation. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about a fish that's sitting belly to the bottom, that 200 kilohertz is going to give me a little better picture, a little better target separation from the bottom.
Is that because it's a narrower?
It's because of the wavelength of the sound is going to be shorter at higher frequencies.
Okay.
So I can get a little better picture. Then if I'm not seeing stuff, I might play around and make it a little wider. The nice thing about most of the units these days is they have something called chirp.
Mm-hmm.
And what chirp does is it sends out a range of frequencies. So let's say I got my, I'll use Lowrance for an example. If I set it on high chirp, I'm going to get a range of frequencies that start at 150 kilohertz and go up to 200.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to give me a little better shape of the object that I'm looking at by running it on chirp. So I do run mine on high chirp a lot, mm-hmm. but 200 kilohertz gives me a good picture as well.
Yeah, that's good to know because the average fisherman has no idea what the difference is between that.
No.
I mean, and it's good to have that why we're doing it, you know, not just trying to read about it because it doesn't make sense. So,
right.
So thanks for the input on that. That's awesome.
So as much as I love sitting here listening to Dan geek out on all these Lowrance things, I think it's time to talk a little bit of tournament fishing.
But I do have one more question.
I was going to say, right before we do that, one more thing that I want him to cover. And he does this for me because I have messed it up enough. But Dan, I know it's important for people to know, and you tell them, I have gone in, I have messed with my sensitivity, I've messed with my chirp, and now I have made a mess. What can I do to fix it?
Restore factory defaults.
There we go.
You don't lose your waypoints.
I have that written in my boat. Factory defaults.
So it does. Restore factory defaults will not take out your waypoints. Will not take out your trails. It may take out your. I tell you, it's been a while since I've done it. It will take out. It may take out your digital overlays that you may have put in place.
Mm-hmm,
okay. One thing that's always a good idea. Anytime you got your sonar set up the way you like it, is save your settings on a chip. And then if you do mess things up, then you can reload your settings and you're good to go. The other things that I always preach is always back up your waypoints.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And since you want to segue into tournament fishing, here's a great one for you. Every day at the end of the day, when you're done fishing, save your waypoints.
That is something we have not covered, and that's a great piece of advice. And I'll tell you why, because when Brad and I went to Escanaba, mm-hmm. everybody, and this is for Dan, Dan knows this because he gave them to me, but Dan gave me a chip full of waypoints, and I don't even know what year that was from, but Dan had saved them and kept the chip, gave it to us, and not only that, but kept the waypoints. He had named the waypoints as far as what he had caught on what. And nice. So he hands us this chip full of waypoints in a gigantic body of water, which kind of helped us narrow down.
Yeah, because we're trying to break down that lake, you're like, oh, Lord.
Yeah.
So that helped us out.
Yeah, Dan says, well, I've got a chip from my PWT days. Here you go. And off we went.
Yeah, so I have one more question, and then we're going to get into the tournament series. So we've talked a little bit about structure scan. And the transducer that you run with structure scan, when you're mounting that, I'd like to talk about mounting that and where that is in relation to your 2D.
Two day.
Had one too many beers.
Yeah. We got to cut the beers off of Brad.
Hey, how come I didn't get any beer?
Because okay. you're about 100 miles away. Yeah. But you can come down. I'll give you one, Dan. No problem.
Okay. So. The newer model units these days, they have the total scan transducer or the all-in-one, three-in-ones. Mm-hmm. All the 2D transducer and your side scan and your down scan are all in the same transducer nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So you don't have to worry about which one's related to where, right?
Mm-hmm.
In my boat, I have a shoot-through epoxied into the hull for my 2D transducer, and my structure scan transducer is mounted on the transom right in front of my motor on a flat spot. It's a Ranger boat. So there's probably about an 8-inch difference between the height between those two transducers.
Okay.
So you will see some difference.
In like the depth that that fish is
in the depth that you're seeing, right?
I see, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's important to note too, because I think a lot of people don't realize that sometimes their depth gets messed up by where they mounted it. and mm-hmm. that could affect the difference between, you know, you see the fish at 10 feet, but they're really, you know, they're really probably closer to 8 feet because of how you are, you know, or deeper. They're probably 12 feet and you've mounted it up a foot or something.
Yeah, for sure. Your transducer, I know on my boats, is about one and a quarter feet deeper than the water line when I'm not on plane.
Sure.
Well, that's good to know since I have one of your boats.
Yes, you do.
You should have maybe told me that a few years ago, Dan.
Yeah, man, Josh keeps telling me, no, dude, we're at 30 feet. I'm like, it can't be. It feels like 29.
Yeah, there is the ability to add an offset.
Oh, there is? I didn't even know that.
It's in one of your sonar settings. But you also got to remember that when you're running on the lake, when you're on plane, mm-hmm. now the boat is running at the surface of the water. Right. So it's not going to be a foot and a quarter anymore. It might only be an inch or two.
Sure.
So be careful if you start playing around with that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. So I think we should dive into a little bit of tournaments.
Well,
stuff.
Heck yeah, you have to dive into some tournaments.
Yeah. So, in our prior podcast and in the Next Level series, we've talked a lot. We spent an hour talking about pre-fishing, and we talked an hour before that talking about just getting ready, the gear that you want to have. And then we've talked about day one. And we haven't even covered day two, but what are some of the things, I would say, when you're going out pre-fishing to a lake that you know or to a brand new lake, what are some successful keys for you when you are breaking down that lake before you even touch the water?
Well, if it's a lake I've never been to, I'm going to spend a lot of time on with paper maps.
Mm-hmm.
And just looking at likely areas. I need to know a lot about the forage. You know, what walleyes only do two things, and one of them is eating. So, and most of the
What's
time...
the other one, sleeping?
Yeah, chasing girls.
Yeah, the big girls. Yeah, they like the big girls.
So they're either spawning, they're either pre-spawn, spawning, or post-spawn. Right, but when they're not spawning, they're eating.
Right,
right. So what are they eating? Are they eating crayfish? Are they eating each other? Are they eating gizzard shad or smelt or shiners or perch or what are they eating?
So you're thinking of the forage in that lake.
I'm thinking about the forage. I've said this to this day. If somebody writes a book just on forage, I will buy that book.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that is the most important part of anything. Find the bait, find the fish.
Yeah,
I've always believed that. So understand the forage. So once you understand the forage, now you can understand the habits of the forage. Is it forage that spawns at a certain water temperature? Are they going to be in the weeds? Are they broadcast spawners? Or are they going to be over here? Are they smelt and they respond at 48 degrees and they're going to run up some river? You know, all that kind of stuff, because that's going to tell me where my walleyes are going to be.
Right.
And then I use the map to identify those likely areas where the food's going to be and where the walleye's going to be based on that.
Do you, how much do you adjust that according to time of year? And obviously you do with the, you know, the, how the bait, you know, like shad spawn a couple times a year, usually, and things like that. But I mean, if it's, you know, an early May tournament and most bait fish haven't spawned, how's that going to affect where you're starting to look then?
Well, if it's an early May tournament on a lake that's full of gizzard shad,
yeah,
I'm going to assume that the walleyes just got off the spawn.
Yep.
And they're going to be, and the shad hasn't even thought about spawning yet.
No. Nope.
So the shad may be suspended. So the bigger fish may be out there feeding on those suspended fish.
Mm-hmm. How big is the shad going to be about then?
It'll be leftover from the year before, so probably a couple inches up to, you know, full length, full size shad. What are they, 6-8 inches?
So a size 7 flicker is about walleye candy time for then.
Size 7's a good choice, maybe even up to a 9.
Yeah,
big.
Right, and if then generally the water temperature is going to be cold, at, you know, around then. So I want maybe run my if I am trolling, I'm going to troll a little slower.
Sure,
I would just want something that's going to wobble.
So the maps are important, figuring out what the forage is important. Now you're on the water. How do you break down a lake? Do you try to, like, if you're going to a tournament, it's kind of a tight-knit circuit in the tournament. So, like, we've talked about, you know, we have buddies. So we've talked about on a tournament series where we kind of break it down because we have two or three teams. So we kind of, like me and Mitch, we'll break down the lake. Josh does the same thing. Do you do that, or do you just try to take it solo yourself? Or what do you do to now start on the water, start breaking down that lake, working those different points that you've identified or the different shorelines that you want to pitch or whatever?
It certainly depends on how much you trust your partners.
Sure. Yeah. Or if you have,
that, or if, that is, right? You're correct on
you're
that.
You're right. You're right. We brought up the same thing. It's because, come on, bud. So whatever they tell you, just do the opposite.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, and these guys are supposed to be fishing with you.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Well, all right. If you can find, if you have good friends, let's just not, you don't even need to call them teams or partners. If you just have good friends and you're willing to share information amongst one another, mm-hmm. You can take a body of water and say, why don't you go to, you know, so-and-so bay,
right?
And why don't you just go pull spinners all day? Mm-hmm. Right. Cause that's what you're good at. And I'm going to go, maybe I'll stay in the same bay and I'm going to pull crankbaits all day.
Sure.
Or maybe I'm going to, or, and you know, then you meet up several times during the day. What are you finding? What's happening? What's going on? Maybe you say, well, geez, none of us is catching any fish. Maybe we should go, if we're going to stay, we're going to focus on this bait today. Let's try casting cranks. Let's try casting jigs. Let's do, you know, different things. Let's throw slip bobbers in the weeds. Mm-hmm. You know, that maybe that's how you want to break up the lake. The other thing you can do is you can say, you go to, if you got somebody who's really versatile, you can say, you go to this bay and you do everything you can think of. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go to that bay and we're going to do everything we can think of. And then we're going to compare notes.
Sure.
So it really kind of depends on team dynamics. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times you get somebody in your team who's just really, really, really good at one thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you send that guy everywhere in the lake and that's the only thing he's going to do.
Right. No, that makes sense. I know that we've had the pleasure of fishing different tournaments with you before, and we've shared some information, and I can guarantee I told you about 50% truth.
Yeah. No, Brad's one of those guys. Yeah,
and that's why Brad doesn't get any calls.
I was telling these guys, usually when you team up like that, it's like, okay, now we know what not to do.
Yeah, right. Now we've zeroed out what not to do. Now let's talk about what we're going to do.
Eliminating water is part of the process as well.
Sure it is.
But sometimes you get that team guy who just can't catch anything, no matter where you put him. So,
Josh,
think about that too.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
yeah, I like Josh.
Well, and I think that was part of the things that we discussed, and some of the stuff I've learned from you was really breaking that down with the. You know, we are fortunate enough to fish when we do fish, still fish tournaments. You know, not as teammates, but the same tournament, we do have a good group of guys that we can share information with and really break up a piece of water. But I think the biggest thing for me has always been being able to come up with those different ways of catching fish. That is something that I always look to do. And I know it's something that you and I have done. You know, if we catch them casting, we also need to try to find out a way to catch them trolling, whether it be spinners or cranks or slow death, whatever, you know. And I think to me that's one of the most important things is when you're breaking it down to come up with techniques too.
Well, that too, but I think versatility is key, mm-hmm. and knowing when to change.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about that.
Game time decisions.
Yeah, game time decisions, but not just on day one or day two, but also pre-fishing, not spending too much time figuring out what is working and really focusing on your job right then. Yep. You know what I mean? Figure it out. Like if I was fishing, me and Mitch were in a boat and you and Josh were in a boat and you were telling us we're going to fish this bay, throw everything you got at it. Well, just because I like to cast jigs, I know that's not my job. I'm going to cast jigs, but I'm gonna do everything I can to try to gain as much information because it becomes that trusting thing between the teams. And you know what? I joke about it. You give 50%, but we have a couple good teams that we fish with all the time. And I truly think when you get to the end of the tournament and everybody's been successful, whether you're 1, 2, 3, or whatever, it's good to see everybody succeed. I think that that's what tournament tournament fishing brings is you get a lot of good friendships out of it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's, I have to say that, you know, that's one of the things I really, really, really miss about the, you know, the major tournaments that I used to fish is all the friends that I made that I don't see anymore.
Mm-hmm. So I got a quick question for you, Dan. And I know that you and I have kind of talked about this, and Brad, Mitch, and I have talked about it. We've done a podcast or two on it. But as you have traveled throughout the Midwest, and by the way, you know, for people who don't know, you're a Minnesota boy, and you're you're a Minnesota alum. And
so, Vikings, are you okay with that? Or
I'm okay with the Vikings.
Yeah,
me too.
But tell me the difference between fishing east of the Mississippi and fishing west of the Mississippi. I think the fishermen that are west of the Mississippi fish different than those that are east of the Mississippi. And I think it's because of the waters and the different types of bottoms and that kind of stuff. But I think there's this difference. Do you, when you were fishing all over with the PWT, and I don't know, did you do RCL?
Yeah,
and you,
I did.
And you did the RCL.
And FLW, too. And I even did an NWT. So.
Cool. When you did all those, and you were fishing, of course, you know, most of those are east, did you see the difference? I mean, do you is that something that is true, or is it something that's kind of, you know, in a figment of my imagination?
Well, I think it comes back around to versatility again. So if you go back to the PWT days and you go back and you look at rookie of the year guys, almost every one of them was from a reservoir based state, mm-hmm. South Dakota, Colorado, Wyoming. And I could name off lots of guys, and obviously there's some others that are just darn good sticks. I mean, you can't beat Pete Harsh, for example, or Rick Olson. Those guys were rookies of the year as well. But the biggest thing that I see is that in our reservoirs fluctuate significantly. You know, we got water coming in, the water goes up, the water goes down. The lake that I guide on fluctuates 50 feet a year. Right.
Wow. Yeah.
In Minnesota, if a lake moves a foot, people freak out. So, yep. It just doesn't happen. So natural lakes are a lot different than reservoirs. Mm-hmm. So, and the other thing about reservoir fish is they move a lot. They're a lot more, you know, they'll be on this point one day or 1 hour and then they're on the next point.
Yeah.
They're not there the next day. So they move around a lot and presentations have to change, locations change, all those kinds of things. Where if you're in Minnesota, you need to be really good at jigging and lindy rigging, right?
Right.
If you go to the Great Lakes, those guys pretty much were trollers, but now they're, of course, they've adopted the shiver minnows, right, and that style of fishing as well, because that's changed because of the gobies and things. Mm-hmm. So flexibility, adaptability is probably more important in walleye fishing and tournaments than anything. And I think the Western guys have an advantage because of it, because they have to, or they can't catch fish.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about that on podcasts and just in general, because you really, I mean, it changes from the morning to the afternoon and then to the evening. It changes sometimes throughout the day. And there's times we've been out to the lake and you come out to it the next week or 2 weeks later and it's dropped 3 feet. You're like, oh my God,
yeah,
everything's different.
Yep. Well, adaptability breeds consistency. And so if you're adaptable and you can go out there and change up what you're doing and you know how to do that and it doesn't throw you for a loop, then, you know, then you're going to be a more consistent fisherman.
Yeah, it just forces you to learn a bunch of different techniques. Yep. Well, it really does.
You have to, but, you know, you do talk as far as bite times during the day, morning, evenings, middle of the day, wind blowing, not blowing, all that kind of stuff. That applies to everywhere,
sure,
not just reservoirs.
Sure. Sure.
And I think also too, another big factor with the reservoir fishermen is, you know, we were talking about the bait and, you know, whether or not the shad are spawning right now or they're going to spawn. You know, we run into situations where they spawn and then the lake drops and that entire cycle gets wiped out. Mm-hmm. And so now we run into a situation where we were catching a ton of walleye come the end of June last year. And this year we can't find any fish because that entire cycle of shad have just gotten wiped out.
Yeah, or vice versa. You got too many, and the fish aren't going to bite because they're just plain full. Yeah.
That's our bigger problem, I think.
Yeah. Well, and that's been the biggest problem lately because we've had good winters and good reservoir levels. But, you know, I can remember several times where, you know, if it gets wiped out too many years in a row, the lake that Dan guides on, it took years for it to come back, years and years and years. And then when it did, holy cow, it came back with a vengeance, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a big thing to remember, too, is that adaptability creates that consistency. And in tournament fishing, that's just huge, you know.
So yeah. I agree completely. So the pre-fish day's over. You get into the tournament days. Let's just say day one. Do you try to – what's your goal? Like we talk about like a milk run and trying to have – I mean, you want as many spots on spots that you can have, right? I mean, if you can have 5, 6, 7 good places that you've identified in pre-fishing that you could focus on during day one – that's great. What's your thoughts on that, having spots, and what do you try to accomplish in pre-fish to get you ready for day one? I mean, as far as the amount of spots, because that's a lot of questions that our listeners send to us all the time. Like, do I just need to find one good spot and stay there all day? Or should I have at least 3? Or should I try to find 10? I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I always said the guy with the most spots wins. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the thing you've got to take into account is, okay, you're pre-fishing. Let's say you're doing a major tournament. You're pre-fishing for a week.
Sure.
And it's on a lake you've never been to before.
And it's a big lake.
And it's a giant lake. Yep. And you did all your homework all winter, and you've got a million waypoints, and you've got your pre-fish pattern. And in the process of working through your pre-fish pattern, you've figured something out. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So let's say that all your pre-fishing happened when you had a strong south wind. Right.
Well, now it's going to blow out of the north once this tournament
And now
starts.
It's going to blow out of the north, right. And all this cold water that was up north is now all over your spots. Right? What are you going to do?
Scratch your head.
How are you going to adapt? Well, and so when you're pre-fishing, you need to think about, okay, if the wind blows from here, what's going to happen? Is it going to blow all the weeds up onto my spot? Is it going to push fish up here? Is it going to push bait up here? Is the bait going to get stirred up and this place is going to go nuts right back in here? You got to think about all that stuff. You also got to think about, okay, I'm up on Green Bay and I'm running all the way to Cedar River and, all of a sudden the wind blows and I can't get there. Right. Mm-hmm. So do I have spots that are close to Green Bay?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I don't, cause I can't make that run.
Right.
You got to think about, you know, what happens. You got to think about all these possible bad things that can happen to you, and do you have spots anywhere nearby? That's kind of what I want to do. I'm going to go out and I'm going to fish my plan. I put together a plan while I'm pre-fishing, and on the day before the tournament, I might just go check all those spots. Mm-hmm. I may not fish them, but I'm going to go look and see if there's fish on there.
Sure,
with my sonar.
See if there's
so I've got. So I've got my, there might be a temperature change, anything like that.
Right.
And then I'm going to go out and hit those spots. And when things don't work, I'm going to start making decisions. One of the worst things that can happen to a guy is, you've got a great spot and you've been fishing and it's overcast and a little bit ripply. You got that nice walleye chop and you're whacking them. And the next day you come out and, by the way, the water's 25 feet. Of clarity.
Yeah.
I have an example anyway that where this happened, right? The water's 25 feet of clarity and all of a sudden there's no wind and you got high bright sun. Where did the fish go?
Right. Right.
Exactly.
So you got to think about all that.
So where did they go, Dan?
They went a little deeper.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I missed them. I dropped from third place on day two to ninth place on day three.
Because still a hell of a showing though.
Yeah. So you know.
Well, yeah, but there's a difference of about $15,000.
Oh, I know. I'm just trying to make you feel good, Dan. That's all I'm trying to do.
Just trying
here.
To give you a little pat.
You know, you're our guest, and I'm just trying to be nice.
Well, and that, you know what, though, that brings up an interesting point. And as you were saying it, Dan, I kind of started to think about it. And, you know, I think it gets lost on a lot of people when that wind does blow opposite, especially in these earlier tournaments. And it starts to move that cold water from one side of the lake towards the other. You know, since that cold water, you know, t- technically is going to be, you know, should probably stay maybe even a little deeper or sink or whatever. It is, as that cold water moves, is part of what you're thinking, because a lot of guys will slide deeper when that happens. You know, I think that warmer water is still going to be up there in the shallower parts of the across the
depends on how
the
much
way.
The wind is blowing. You know,
well, even
it,
then.
It can depend on whether or not it's protected too.
Sure.
I've seen Devil's Lake as an example. I had a perfect spot, and then the wind shifted from the south and it came from the north, and it was blowing that cold water from the north over the top of the point I was fishing, and there was nothing there. I mean, it was vacant.
Did they?
But those fish. Well, I went to an entirely different spot. Yeah. But I looked for a place where, like you said, Josh, shallow. They could go shallow, especially if the sun's
right.
out. They might move up. The water may roam up. They might go in the weeds. They might. I mean, who the heck knows exactly where they go? But don't stay on a spot too long, I think, is probably the key.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about that, and we got our own feelings on, like, if you have multiple spots and it's day one and you're hitting your spots. First of all, were you at that spot at the same time of day? And when you're getting there, is there fish? And how long do you stay? Let's say it's a casting bite and you're casting up to shore because that's how you've hammered in the last couple of days. And now you get there and they're not there. Well, I know that the way me and Mitchell fish it, you know, if there's nothing in 10, 15 minutes and we know the fish were there and we're not marking them, we're out. We're off to spot two or three or whatever that is. Do you have that same philosophy, or will you pound it out for a little bit longer and just wait for them to come in?
Most of the time, although Joshka and I got charged for loitering once.
Yeah, we really got charged. That was our biggest lesson.
Yeah. But because we kept thinking, those fish are going to come in. They're going to come in. They're going to come in. They never did. So, you know, it happens.
Yeah.
You get burned sometimes. But, yeah, the smartest thing to do. But you also don't want to get into the trap of running around.
I know.
Right. So, you know, try work through your program. You know, what changed? You know, is the water a little different color? Is the water a little different temperature? Right. So you go through your crankbaits and it's like, okay, it was bright and clear and sunny when I was here last time, and now it's cloudy and dirty. So do I want to try something a little different color that they can see? You know, so you're going to start making those kinds of changes, or maybe I need to up my profile, maybe go a little smaller. You start thinking about that. But once you've done a few of those things, then, you know, yeah, it is time to move on.
Yeah.
It does help when you got a partner, because your partner can be throwing something different than you.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And doing two different things at once is always good. Even like we talked before, even when we're like casting jigs, because that's what we're talking about right now, that we will do different size jig heads or different size jig colors or bodies or whatnot until we can really hone on what's happening on day one. Because it might be completely different or somewhat different on day one of the tournament than it was 2 days prior, you know.
Oh, certainly.
So I think that a lot of the stuff that you're talking about is really good to hear, because I know that we share a lot of the same philosophies on that, on what we do, the consistency being versatile, and how we kind of break down the lake. We do a lot of the same stuff. It's good to hear. But I think what our listeners, the guys that are just getting into it or that have been fishing tournaments, is to really start taking these different, there's a lot to it other than just showing up and going fishing.
Yeah.
You got a lot to process, and the time to start that is not the day before the tournament of pre-fishing, looking at your maps, looking at your stock or what the prior catch rate was there, what you've been successful doing there. There's a lot of things to consider.
Oh yeah. It always helps to have a good log of what you've done in previous tournaments. So, you know, where was the moon? What was this? You know, how much, what was the wind? What was the water temperature? Was it air temperature? Yada, yada, yada. You write all that stuff down. Mm-hmm. I know when I'm pre-fishing, one of the things I do is when I do catch a fish, mm-hmm. I have a log book. I'll catch a fish and I'll go, okay, the water temp was this, sky was this, I was using this bait, I was reeling this fast. I write all that stuff down, and that's waypoint number one. Mm-hmm. Right. Then I go to waypoint number two and I catch another fish and I write all that information down. And then that helps me process it. It also gives me a record for the next time I come back. And I'm going to say, I'm going to start looking at those places. I don't want to get stuck fishing memories, but I got to at least have a place to start.
Well, we talked about that in the last one. I don't think fishing memories is a bad thing. You just, the trap with fishing memories is you stay too long. You say they're going to be here. They were here before. You know, the memory part is what leads you to check these different spots. And if they're there, great. But if you roll up and they're not on the graph, or you know, it's just it's not happening, then you have to go. You can't let the memory suck you in like a quicksand. You know,
I tell you, a few years ago, I kept a log. And I tell you what, looking back on that, it was awesome to have it written down because, you know, just like you, Dan, we fish a lot. We catch a lot of fish, you know, a lot of different lakes, and it all kind of jumbles together. But to be able to see it all written down, it's like, oh, yeah, perfect. And yeah. Sure enough, the next year, I replicated it. Bingo. It worked great.
Well, I know we've had the logs before, and we've showed up on a lake that we fished a bunch in. And I'll be driving to one shoreline thinking this is where we're going to start. And Mitch is like, dude, what are you doing? We're on the other side of the lake. And I'm thinking of a completely different lake. So he pulls it out, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that was Jumbo. That's not Sterling. What am I thinking? You know, but you get it. It's hard to remember that stuff. But it's also super important because even if you have an elephant memory, that would be awesome. But, maybe not. Well, some of the stuff that Josh has said, I don't want to remember. Yeah. But even with that, it does jumble together, and to make you successful, to make you time management is huge. To cut down on wasting time is super important.
Well, it helps you build on what your experience with it. Sure. You know, it might not be the answer, but it sure is a great starting point.
Yeah, and it also can set you up for different scenarios, even when you go to a different lake, right? So you say, "Gee, I fished something." A lake just like this somewhere else that had the same exact
cover. Oh, that's a great cover. Point. Yeah, no, that's right? A great point because you do
so
take
maybe
stuff
I should try this.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. Well, and it's funny because as we sit here and we discuss all the, you know, all the possibilities of a day one or day two and all the possibilities between you catch fish and pre-fish and you don't in the tournament, everything we have discussed, there's two things that haven't come up or one thing in particular that hasn't come up. Well, it did for a second is... The last thing we look at is color, right? Yeah. Dan said I might use a little bit different colors so they can see it better. But other than that, we have talked about, you know, water temperature, changing it. We've even talked about the moon, but we have not discussed we've got to just change what we do with color. And I think that go ahead, Dan. I think that goes to being different, you know.
Well, I think that's true. But I think, you know, the first thing you think about when you're picking, choosing a bait, whether it's a crankbait or a jig or whatever, right? What depth does it run?
Yep.
Okay. Then you got to think about size and vibration. You know, are you trying to match the hatch? You're just trying to draw attention to it, right? And then probably the last thing I worry about is color. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But sometimes color can make a difference. So if you're getting a fish that's just nipping, you're getting bites, but you're not hooking.
Yeah.
Sometimes it helps to change the color.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't really put a lot of credence in color, but there are certain times when it really does matter.
When it matters, it matters.
It does. You'll know that.
I've got a question for all of you guys. Interesting that you say that. I just watched a video on YouTube about a guy who is tying crawler harnesses with about a 8 to 9 inch gap between the blade and the hooks. And his theory is when you start getting, you know, and a lot of those guys use full night crawlers, which you all know I'm not a fan of. But when you're getting nipped at, the reason you're getting nipped at is because the blade is too close to the hooks. It doesn't look natural enough. It kind of freaks them out, right? It pushes them away. They come up, they swipe at it because they don't want to get near the blade, and they're off and going. So his theory is if you move, the blade is nothing but an attractor anyways, whether it be sound, flash, whatever, vibration. Mm-hmm. His idea is that, you know, you move it up 4, 5, 6 inches, maybe more away from the hooks, and that thump brings in those fish. But as they're coming up to inspect the thump, they run into the meat, the scent, all that gets, you know, comes into them, and they strike, and you end up catching more fish. What are your thoughts on that? Because I thought it was an interesting idea. I'm not sure I buy into it, but I thought it was interesting.
Well, I think, okay, so I can see moving the blade forward because the blade is your attractor. Mm-hmm. And so if they're going to the attractor and they happen and the hooks are far enough back, it's kind of like putting a stinger hook on a minnow.
Right.
Right. You're going to hook them further back. So I can kind of see that.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense to me. So it's almost like fishing cowbells with the
Wow, jeez.
hey, don't knock cowbells, because I've seen guys in Great Lakes pulling stuff that is, you might as well call it cowbell.
Have you seen guys at Chatfield doing it?
Yeah,
because I have, and it didn't work real well for them.
Yeah, well. Well, but what do you think, Brad? I mean, do you think that's
So here's my thing. You know, when you're fishing, we're talking about sevens and nines when we're talking crankbaits. And I see what the guy's, what he is trying to, his story he's trying to tell. But I also think that there's a time where you have your flash and your vibration, but now you have that full extended crawler if he's using. Is that almost, does it become a hindrance of being too big of a bait? What are you trying to accomplish there? I mean, you're trying to catch fish, but now you have something that could be 13 inches long. Is that going to scare the fish? I don't know.
I don't think it scares the fish. I think, well, are you still, or, am I still here?
Yeah,
you're
still here.
Okay, I just got a lost connection to server thing pop up. Anyway,
well, Dan had a lost signal.
Yeah, so I don't think the size of the bait.
We'll try to get him back, but I think that's one of those things where it's going to scare the fish.
But I don't necessarily buy into it.
I have watched. Have you guys ever
something
used
I want to try?
Well, have you ever used those keel weights?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so how many times I know that we have had fish come up and just drill those kill weights.
Mm-hmm.
They've gone past the spinner. Mm-hmm. They've gone past the meat, past the scent, and wham, they whack those kill weights.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you know, there's no hooks on the kill weights. So if there's no hooks on the kill weights, then the kill weight isn't doing much of anything other than just
there's no action, nothing, right?
If they're going after that thump and that vibration and that spin of the spinner, then, you know, and there's no hook, there's nothing there. What if they do whack that spinner? What if they are whacking it? We've all seen it where they've got the front hook in their lip and the back hook halfway down their throat. Well, they're inhaling the whole thing.
Yeah, you're right. And a lot of times, so we've taken it a little bit different than that. We've added a few extra beads to get a little bit of separation, but I've never ran my beads 6-8 inches up.
No, I kind of want to try it.
I think it's a great concept. I'm always looking for something new to do and trying to learn a new technique. But, you know, I don't know. You know, it's just a mere guess. You know, I'm thinking, geez, that ends up being a 13-14-inch bait. But we've all seen walleye inhale those things. So is that an issue? Probably not an issue. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'd like to thank Dan Swanson for giving us his guidance in the Lowrance part and his wisdom in the fishing tournaments part. I've spent a lot of years fishing with Dan. I met Dan a long time ago through another PWT pro of his who ended up being a boss of mine, Gary Darling. And so, through the years, how I first met Dan was he had ran his boat across a sandbar and broke his prop. And he actually ended up using my boat for a tournament, which was a crazy big thing for me because I didn't trust anybody to use my boat. So I loaned my boat to Dan, and we've been friends ever since. So, he's
a great guy, super knowledgeable.
Yep. We don't always agree on everything, but he's really that's what makes it great, is because we can disagree, and we had that type of relationship.
Yeah, from the time you guys met.
Yeah, I tell you, if anybody's looking for a good guide in any of those lakes, Horsetooth, Carter, up at Glendo, give Dan a call at Fishful Thinker.
Yeah,
that guy's great, and he will get you on the fish.
You bet. Yep. Well, so from everybody at All Eyes on Fishing, thank you for joining us on the Next Level. Hey, make sure that you are sending this out and letting others know about the Next Level. We really enjoy doing the podcast, but we really enjoy diving a little bit deeper into the Next Level and getting that information out to you. Also, just want to make sure that anybody there that's going to our website at alleyesonfishing.com, check out our apparel, our gear, and we got a lot of orders, so it takes a little bit to fill them because they're all handmade, handcrafted, I guess. But I guess I just want to say thanks again to Dan, and from all of us at All Eyes on Fishing, have a great night. Thanks for following us.
Thanks, everyone.
This has been All Eyes on Fishing. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, go ahead and subscribe to The Next Level. And you can hear longer podcasts and more information on all of your favorite topics. And check us out at alleyesonfishing.com for apparel, blogs, and other information. Don't forget to check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. All Eyes on Fishing, leading you to the next level.